Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. She's fiery, passionate, beautiful, witty, and she's got a voice that'll blow you away. Carmen is coming to the Triad courtesy of Piedmont Opera, and we'll walk a mile in her shoes and corset with mezzo-soprano Mabel Ledo. Then it's a walk on the wild side with a slew of gifted 21st century composers, a stable of new music warriors, and a man with a vision. Forecast Music's Eric Schwartz is here with Music for Man and Machine. John Cage turns 100 at Wake Forest University. Award-winning organist Tim Olson pulls out all the stops at Music for a Great Space. New Song Music Group comes to the Carolinas, and pianist Peter Karoff is back with a look at 19th century American masters. You know, Chadwick, McDowell, Parker. No? Well, don't fret, it's Karoff at the keyboard to the rescue, next on Triad Arts Weekend. In 1884, the New York Times welcomed Bizet's, quote, pretty and effective work to the Metropolitan Opera. But by the beginning of 2011, the Met alone had performed it almost 1,000 times. Well, next weekend, Carmen comes to the Triad with performances on Friday, October 26th at 8, Sunday at 2, and Tuesday the 30th at 7:30 in the Stevens Center in Winston-Salem. Lots of special events surrounding the performances as well, and you'll find links to more at wfdd.org/triadarts. Mezzo-soprano Mabel Ledo, who sings the role of Carmen, and Piedmont Opera Artistic Director Jamie Albritton drop by to talk about it. Mabel, I want to talk about the music from the singer's perspective as Carmen. These arias, the grand choruses, are so familiar to us now. What sorts of things do you need to be aware of as a performer, as the singer?
The composer meant for this role to be sung by a soprano, but somehow I think because of the weight lies on the voice, it fits very, very well for the mezzo-soprano voice. I find it very, very comfortable. Oh. It is a little bit challenging because she is, you know, moving around and, you know, flirting and dancing, and you really have to get a kind of a grip of your body and your voice. You know, it's a balancing act, like a ballet. The voice, the theatrical part, the dancing, there's so much, the movement, and you just have to know where to give, where to, you know, take a little bit. But it is very, very comfortable. For me, it's the best role. It just kind of fits like a glove.
She's so honest to herself, raw, ahead of her time. Was there a prototype for her leading up to Carmen? Was there a role like that or a character that had that strong a woman role?
You know, again, I think that's one of the reasons why this is such an interesting opera. I mean, don't forget that it was based on a novel that was very popular at the time as well, Carmen Prosper Mérimée. She's sort of the poster girl for women's lib, if you will. The liberation that she shows, particularly at that time, if you think about the women that would have been sitting in that audience watching her, that would have been one of the reasons why this was so popular, is because here's this woman who's telling all the men what to do, mm-hmm. who's not worrying about how tight her corset is, you know, who walks out there with her feminine wiles and mows everybody down. That must have been an amazing character to watch in the middle of the 19th century in the opera house.
And this is a period when women are supposed to act in a particular way. They're supposed to be very feminine, very girly. And she's this, you know, bigger-than-life person behaving almost like a man in a sexual way. But for those women who maybe felt like, wow, I wish I'd had the freedom to come out of my shell and be more like her. So she was kind of a hero or an icon for women of her time.
Wearing that outfit and the bustier and all that stuff, is it uncomfortable? Is it more difficult?
I mean, it's a little uncomfortable because you're kind of like, you know, bound. But yeah. When you look down and you kind of see how sexy you look, it's a motivator for me. Like, hey, this is only going to make me portray my role even better. When we wear high heels, you know, we just bear the pain because we know how good our legs look. So it's, you know, you just kind of have to go with that and just feel the pain and bear it. And
it's better to look good than to feel good.
You know, we just go out there and do it. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if it hurts.
I'm glad I asked that.
Yes.
I've always wanted that. Je l'ai mise à la portière. Mon amour, nothing speaks to that that power like Seguidilla.
Well, you know, she really uses the Seguidilla. She's really, I don't want to say taunting. She is...
She's teasing him.
Yes, she's teasing, you know, this poor Don José. He has been put in charge of taking her to the prison. And so she knows exactly how to get her way with a man. And so she teases him and she says, you know, I know this place up in the mountains. And if you're nice to me, maybe we could meet up there at Lilas Pastias and we could drink manzanilla and we could do all sorts of interesting things if you just take this little rope off of my hand.
And I think, like, she also, she's enticed by him, you know, because he's so different from men that she's used to courting, for lack of a better word. And so she wants to be with him. And so she will do anything not to go to jail. And at the same time, you know, get what she wants. It's like a win-win situation. So she is like, this is what you're going to get, honey, me. And it can't get any better than that. So let me go and you will have all your dreams fulfilled, sort of speak.
Carmen, je suis comme un livre, si je cède, si je me livre, ta promesse, tu la tiendras, ah, si je t'aime, Carmen, Carmen, tu m'aimeras.
Georges Bizet, Prodigy, but in terms of this opera, what point in his life was he at leading up to it? And did he hear it?
He did. This is. Oh, I don't know. 30 seconds before the end of his life here.
He was coming down to the wire there.
Yeah, it's a sad story actually, because when you think about how popular Carmen is now, and poor Georges never knew. that to me is one of the interesting things about confronting this opera as the conductor. The opera was written originally for the Opéra Comique. I mean, if you wanted something light, you went to the Opéra Comique. If you wanted opera, you went to the opera. And so he writes this opera, and it's full of tragedy, and the characters are very dark. But it's got lots of numbers that the audience there would have enjoyed. It was originally written without recitatives. It was originally written as number, dialogue, like you would expect for the Opéra Comique. And because of the shady characters and the fact that at the end our heroine, if you want to call her that, is murdered on stage, it received a terrible premiere. And it was the tragedy of poor Bizet's life, and 6 months later he passed. So he had no idea what success this piece went on to. And ultimately, one of his students, Guiraud, was the one that sort of began to politic for it to go to the opera. And he actually wrote the recitatives that we are all familiar with now. They were not written by Bizet. So what we commonly know as Carmen is actually a version of Carmen that was put together after Bizet's death so that it would be accepted at the opera.
And the non-musician, the recitative?
Recitative is the sung dialogue. So in other words, initially in its first version, there was speech. They sang a number and then they spoke to each other. It was dialogue, like a musical would be in our American parlance. And then when it went to the opera, because it was in the, quote, opera, they had to set the speech to music so that it was a recitative like there would have been in grand opera. So it was sung speech rather than spoken speech.
Mm-hmm. The Toreador song, and something that always perplexed me in the lyrics, you know, the dark eye watching you, but you've got love on the other side. What's the dark eye? What set that one up?
That's a good question. What is the dark eye?
The bull, isn't it?
Is it?
Death?
Is it? Or as I look into your eyes, Mabel, that are dark.
Oh.
What is the dark eye? We meet this powerful man, Escamillo, this bullfighter who sings this whole aria about the strength he shows in the ring fighting the bulls. He has an exact counterpart in Carmen. Obviously, he is telling in that aria the narrative of what it's like to be in the bull ring. But as he sings about the dark eye, he just happens to be looking across the room at Carmen.
Mm.
Mm.
So what is the dark eye?
Interesting. I love that intrigue. And within that, maybe that's what those sorts of things make this so powerful. In general, it's a celebration of strong-hearted men, you know, selling the life of the Toreador. You don't need to speak the language. You just get a sense of the celebratory nature of it. Jason Wixon is going to perform the role of Don Jose, emerging as one of the next leading tenors in the U.S. Jamie, what's that trajectory like?
Jason is a graduate of the IU School of Music and did a lot of great work there.
Indiana University?
Yes, Indiana University School of Music. He's going to sing Florestan in Fidelio, I believe, for Milwaukee before this season is over with. And he'll be singing Eric in Flying Dutchman for the Princeton Festival next summer. So, I mean, his career is really, really going in an extraordinary direction. And I think when you hear him sing, you'll be excited and you'll want to keep track of him.
You hear about that sort of quality and Mabel's voice being described by the New York Times as a warm, expressive mezzo-soprano, and coming up also in this, our Toreador, no slouch either. In fact, last we spoke, I'm talking about baritone Michael Redding. You and he stopped by to talk about Don Giovanni.
That's
and his
right.
role, and his leading role there. And then he just skipped off to the Berlin Philharmonic and a little concert preview, Porgy and Bess with none other than Simon Rattle. I mean,
yeah.
If that doesn't speak to the quality of Piedmont Opera and the vocalist, I don't know what does.
No, I'm very proud of Mike's career. And I might say, appearing in that concert as well was another UNCSA alumni, Tashina Vaughn. So we had two UNCSA people involved in that concert with Simon Rattle. A diehard NCSA opera fan. You'll remember her from A Così Fan Tutte 15 years ago, maybe.
Oh, great. All right. Mezzo-soprano Mabel Ledo, who sings the role of Carmen, and Piedmont Opera Artistic Director Jamie Albritton. Mabel will be joined by Jason Wixon as Don Jose and baritone Michael Redding as Escamillo in the Piedmont Opera's production of Georges Bizet's Carmen. Performances begin next weekend in the Stevens Center on Friday, October 26th at 8, Sunday at 2, and Tuesday the 30th at 7:30. There are lots of fun, special Carmen-related events leading up to the performances as well, and you'll find ticket information and links to more at wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and there's lots of great music yet to come on the show today, beginning with forecast music and a few names that may be new to you. But first, it's time for a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We've got Karoff at the keyboard coming up in the second half of the show, John Cage, singer-songwriters, and Music for a Great Space. But first, Forecast Music is an adventurous new music group founded in Brooklyn, New York, back in 2001. Forecast Music's mission is to present innovative American music in both traditional concert halls as well as venues that might just surprise you. On Thursday night, Forecast Music and Performance at SICA presented the Triad Composers Project No. 2, Man and Machine, at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art. Forecast now calls Winston-Salem home, and its roster includes some of the world's finest composers and performers living right here in North Carolina. Man and Machine featured works by John Beck, Lawrence Dillon, Mark Engelbretson, Michael Rothkopf, Alejandro Ruti, and Forecast Music co-founder, pianist, and very appreciative composer, Eric Schwartz.
One of the both economically and artistically most interesting and useful genres of 21st century music is this sort of interactive electroacoustic music where you have a live performer sort of playing a duet of sorts with electronics. And this concert in particular has a whole bunch of that. That's going to affect the sound parameters in a way that's only sort of preordained. So it really is this juxtaposition of the organic, the man side, with the computer, the pre-programmed, the synthetic sounds.
What's a good example from a previous concert, a work that mixes the two, electronica and an acoustic work that we might sample?
Well, we had a wonderful piece on our first Triad Composers Concert from last year, which was Lawrence Dillon, Spark in the Dark. That was a piece for bassoon, saxophone, and electronics. Electronic sequencing of acoustic sounds. So again, you have that sort of juxtaposition of the natural sounds, but they're tinkered with, they're studioized. And, I really think that's an interesting avenue, and it's very effective, you know, amplification and a lot of sound mass with only, you know, two people playing, and that can be a very powerful thing. I mean, you can make a whole lot of noise.
Great. Well, let's sample from some of this. This is music by Larry Dillon.
I mean, Larry is just a really polished, extraordinarily technically proficient composer who writes beautiful music. I mean, he's essentially a child prodigy. I believe he was the youngest PhD graduate from Juilliard. Just really somebody whose music, I think, beautifully represents what 21st century composers do.
I like symmetry, but I like symmetry that gets kind of interrupted. And that's like the perfect thing. You get the symmetry of sound, just that raw acoustic sound, and then these very angular, disjointed, seemingly electronic sounds makes for a completely unique package.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really beautiful thing. I mean, I have never had a particular interest in purely electronic music because there's a potential, at least, for a lack of that organic element. But when you take advantage of the electronic sound palette in juxtaposition with the acoustic sound palette, with the virtuosity of some of these amazing musicians, it's just very effective.
And as you know, more than any, as a composer and performer yourself, you get a mediocre performer, you get a mediocre performance. I mean,
sure.
It really takes someone to rise to the level of these sometimes very complex and difficult pieces to play, other times not. But let's face it, it helps if you've got a great performer to bring out the music in these wonderful works. And you've got a whole stable full. Let's talk about some of them.
Yeah, we have amazing performers. I mean, you know, the main thing about 21st century music is the techniques, the sounds, the rhythms, the language is just not exactly straight on the same thing as, you know, your Schumanns and your Tchaikovskys and your 19th century warhorse composers. And so what we have here, particularly in Forecast, is these real fearsome contemporary music specialists, these people who love this music, who are particularly titillated by the challenges they present and are just, you know, they're world-class classical performers, but they have a special bent for 21st century. We have Tamer Sullivan, who is of the Prism Quartet, which is just an extraordinarily fantastic contemporary saxophone quartet. And we have John Beck, who is an amazing percussionist, not only a contemporary music devotee, but in this concert, actually a composer as well. He'll be performing an original work of his own, which I'm very, very excited about, a series of riffs off of music from West Side Story for solo percussion. That's going to be super cool.
Super, what a neat concept. And then Michael Burns, another outstanding musician and a champion of both, as you mentioned, classical music and contemporary music, and very few, if any, technical restraints on this guy in bassoon.
Yeah, he's outrageous. You know, the bassoon is obviously not one of the sexier instruments in terms of the repertory. Bassoonists, much like saxophonists and percussionists, are more inclined, I think, naturally to be drawn to newer repertoire. They don't have quite the body of music that some of those other instruments have. And Michael really understands contemporary music and does amazing things with what is a big, often clownish instrument. He makes it anything but. I mean, he does fantastic things.
early on, we mentioned From Brooklyn to Winston-Salem with Love, and classic case in point, Jackie Carrasco, My Lovely Wife, and also bringing some of that contemporary music experience from groups like Cygnus Ensemble and SEM, Mark Morris Dance Company, to Winston-Salem.
Yeah, Jackie has the ability to, you know, play with the lean, mean, you know, vibrato-free, rock and roll-influenced contemporary sound that we, you know, we need violinists to use for much, not all, but much of this modern repertoire, and just does it so well.
Another instrument that falls in that category, certainly your instrument, piano, and one of the best, James Douglas, right here in the Triad, and such a well-prepared is overused. It seems like a pretty bland, generic way, but just the preparation and commitment to the music is something you really appreciate in the audience.
Yeah, I mean, James is just amazing, just an incredibly powerful, virtuosic performer. He's also a total goofball, and for works that are a little on the goofier side, you could not ask for a better you know, shrieker or reciter. Or whatever nonsensical things we sometimes ask our performers to do. Jim is always game.
This is not a test.
Mezzo-soprano Clara O'Brien. Tell me about Clara.
Clara is someone with a beautiful, rich, operatic mezzo, but at the same time, incredible ear. She's just as comfortable in sort of, hyper-dissonant, Webernian, early 20th century modernism as she is with the sort of, 21st century postmodernism.
And who expects to be transfigured or transformed?
One of the composers on the roster, a man who thought outside the box really from high school onward, if not before, John Cage, and what an impact he had on not only music, but poetry and visual art and so many other things that we almost take for granted today. But what has John Cage meant to you as a composer, performer, I mean, on his 100th birthday, looking back on the man?
Sure. For me, the experience I always think back on is sometime in my first couple years in New York City, I went to a Manhattan School of Music contemporary ensemble concert. They did a John Cage piece surrounded by performers who had various objects. They had paper, they had bowls of water, they had wood, they had just these found objects that were amusical for all intents and purposes. And with low lighting for about 15 minutes, they just made sounds. I just didn't want it to end. That experience particularly has really profoundly influenced, you know, music that I wrote after that.
What are some of the hallmarks of Mark's style? Talking about Mark Engelbritzen.
Mark is on the faculty at UNCG, and, you know, one of the things I think Mark has a real abiding interest in is this juxtaposition of electronics with acoustic sounds. He's got a pretty fascinating work for narrator, electronic keyboard, and live interactive electronics. He really likes color and timbre and morphing sounds, you know, really changing the way sounds sound with electronics.
What's your piece going to be like?
It's called My Unformed Self, which is actually the Hebrew translation of that is Gollum, you know, the old Hebraic clay figure. And it's a piece that really brings that Jewish soul that is buried somewhere deep within me. This is music that I grew up with. This is music near and dear to my heart. So I have created a extremely postmodern klezmer-influenced work and has since been premiered and toured across the country, but this will be the North Carolina premiere. It's a work I'm very excited about. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Put our listener in the seats there. This is going to be a Sika collaboration.
Yes,
and,
yes, indeed.
What's it going to feel like, sound like, you know, at Sika?
It's going to sound good. Sika, a very exciting thing. They've introduced this new Performance at Sika series, which is a series of Thursday night concerts. Sika is, of course, our Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art. It's a fantastic museum and contemporary art exhibition space. But they also have a wonderful auditorium, a very informal, relaxed setting. You're going to be surrounded by contemporary art, and you're going to get this oral contemporary art. I think it's a perfect marriage.
Forecast Music co-founder, award-winning composer, pianist, and University of North Carolina School of the Arts music director for the School of Dance, Eric Schwartz. You'll find links to upcoming Forecast Music performances on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take another short break now. Then it's Understanding Classical Music with Karoff at the keyboard and a look at the forecast musicians of the 1800s. 20th century maverick John Cage turns 100, and organist Tim Olson plays Music for a Great Space next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this is Steinway artist and Wake Forest University professor Peter Karoff at the keyboard.
You know, at the end of the 19th century in the United States, there were a number of really wonderful composers, mostly living in New England, Boston, New York, considered among the best composers of the time in any country, but we sort of lost track of them. Now, these are names that might not be familiar to you. There's a composer called George Whitefield Chadwick, for example. Not a name that is up there with Beethoven or Brahms anymore, but while he was alive, he was considered one of the great living composers. Horatio Parker, likewise, well-respected in his day, taught at Yale, taught the next generation of composers, including Charles Ives and others. They tended to compose in a style that more or less imitated the models that they knew from Europe. Chadwick, Parker, and so many of these other composers went to Europe to study, either in Paris, Frankfurt in Germany, and Cologne, various places. And they learned the European models from their teachers and, of course, also from the published music. They were imitating Schumann and Mendelssohn and all the other great European masters. They're great craftsmen, these American composers, and often quite beautiful. But for whatever reason, at the end of their lives, taste shifted and they've kind of fallen through the cracks of history. Here's a sweet piece by George Whitefield Chadwick, composed in about 1905, and it's in the style of a barcarolle. Now, barcarolle is a boat song. Chopin wrote a barcarolle. A number of other European composers wrote them. But this barcarolle has an American subtitle. It's called In the Canoe. An American boat is not a European boat. And like a typical barcarolle, you can hear the rocking, rolling waves in the left hand and the lovely melody in the right above. Now, in those kaleidoscopically shifting harmonies from here to here to here, I hear the hand of Gabriel Fauré, for example, teacher of Debussy, who also wrote some barcarolles around the same time, actually, 1905. Beautiful stuff, charming, and definitely worthy of our listening. Another composer around the same time, actually a friend of Chadwick's, was Horatio Parker, a dean of the School of Music at Yale, composing in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. Here's a piece called Étude Mélodieuse, the Melodious Étude. Now, an étude is a study piece. We mostly think of Chopin as composing études. And here Parker is writing a little accompaniment like a harp, which floats along repeatedly, and on top of that, a melody is projected. And the challenge of this étude then is to play both quietly and while at the same time projecting the melody. Thank you. was charming stuff, beautiful, beautiful stuff. But again, more or less forgotten, currently unpublished. I feel close to these composers, and I'm happy to resurrect them to some degree. George Whitefield Chadwick, Horatio Parker, Arthur Foote, so many of these composers, many of them based around Boston or New York at the turn of the century, these American romantics.
Steinway artist and Wake Forest University professor Peter Kiroff at the keyboard. I'm David Ford, and this is Triad Arts Weekend. One American composer who picked up the baton from those who came before him, or maybe he just made his own baton, was a man by the name of John Cage. He was one astonishing individual. His compositions upended long-held conventions about the listening process and prodded us to reevaluate how we define not only music, but the entire experience of encountering art. Those are the words of Wake Forest University professor and pianist Louis Goldstein. His Cage Fest continues through November 13th and celebrates what would have been Cage's 100th birthday with a variety of fascinating lectures, recitals, exhibits, and performances by some of the world's leading Cage interpreters. While Cage's music influenced an entire generation of American composers who followed him, Louis is hoping that Cage Fest shines a light on the lesser-known but equally important other artistic contributions made by his hero, John Cage.
This is a much refined drum-like sound compared to the weather stripping that he started out with in 1940. But also rattles.
How did he come up with the idea of basically preparing the piano such that the strings create not just your piano sound, but a whole panoply of sounds?
It was a case of necessity being the mother of invention. He was working at the time at a small school in Seattle, Washington, called the Cornish School, where there was a dance program. He was employed to provide music for the dance program. There were several talented dancers there during that time. That's where he and Merce Cunningham originally met. And another talented dancer who had a professional life after graduating from Cornish was Sevilla Fort. She came to Cage asking him to provide music for a dance she was making that she wanted, among other things, to express her feelings about her African-American heritage. So Cage, being known at the time as a percussion composer and as a composer for the dance, seemed like the perfect person to ask. And he said, yes, I will make music for your dance, even though he knew there was one crucial problem with fulfilling that promise, and that was the performance space where the dance would be performed. There was no room for percussion equipment. There was no pit, and there weren't even any wings to the side. It was just a stage and a lot of chairs that came right up to the stage. There was a baby grand piano that was wedged in between the seats and the stage, and that was all that could be used as a sound source.
How about that?
So in one reminiscence, Cage said that he spent some time trying to find an African-sounding 12-tone row. And when he proved to himself that that could not be done, he decided that instead of thinking there was something wrong with him not being able to come up with appropriate music, that there was something wrong with the piano. Cage had studied with Henry Cowell, who was the first composer to actually use the inside of the piano. Cowell had strummed it and plucked strings and muted strings. So Cage reviewed all of those ideas and then went one step further. He started placing objects on the strings. He mentions trying out a pie plate and liking the jangling sound that that made, but the pie plate flew all over the inside of the piano. It turns out that those strings, you might not be able to see them vibrate, but they have quite a little kick when the hammer hits the string. And eventually he just thought of the idea that a screw or a bolt that was slightly wider than the space of two strings strung on the piano, wedged in between those strings, would actually be held up by the vibrating strings instead of being thrown out of place. Mm. So that act of pressing one bolt between two strings of the piano is the invention of the prepared piano. He was a true multi-artist. Not like a composer who, for example, writes a libretto for his own opera, and that's the extent of his literary output. Cage actually invented a new form of poetry, which astonishes me every time I say it, because I never even had thought of the concept of inventing a new form of poetry. But he came up with an idea he called misostic. A misostic is like an acrostic, where the capital letters go down the left-hand side of the page and begin sentences. A misostic has capital letters going down the middle of a page, and the what he called the wing words usually cross the spine, the vertical words, but they can start with them or they can end with them. There's no pattern to the look of the lines. And Cage being Cage, there are rules that he made up that he had to follow. For example, the next capital letter cannot appear between one capital and another.
Okay.
So sometimes he wrote in the misostic form in a way that is really a traditional expression of poetry, expressing his own ideas and explaining his thoughts. Other times, Cage being Cage, he used a technique that he also invented called writing through, which is not using his own original words, but taking texts that were important to him in some way and mining that source for words that fit the misostic that he was writing at the time. Sometimes the misostic has to do with the spine words. He usually used names. For example, Marcel Duchamp, who is an important person to him. There are misostics that are titled Re and Not Re Marcel Duchamp, because some of them have to do with Marcel and some don't. And he used that formula for titles with other people that he either wrote about or didn't write about, just using their names as the spine of his misostic. And there are about four volumes worth of poetry that he wrote in this form. He was actually prolific in that field. My reason for suggesting Steve Drury for this particular year was because it is the centennial birthday of John Cage. When that came through, I thought, well, maybe this can be something bigger. So I looked to other aspects of Cage's creativity. Speaking with Paul Bright, who was about to become the director of the Haynes Art Gallery in the Scales Fine Arts Center, he said that he would be interested in having a gallery show of Cage's work. So that idea took flight. I knew that Marjorie Perloff was a highly respected literary critic who took Cage seriously as a poet. I contacted her. She responded immediately and said, I would love to come and talk about Cage as a poet. It was easy to supplement that program with a couple of musicologists. David Patterson is a musicologist who has specialized in the early part of Cage's career. He will be here in November. And David Patterson, by the way, is going to speak on Cage and politics. Cage had a spottier record with his political ideas than he did with other things. There are things to criticize about his political ideas. I came in contact with an art critic named Kay Larson. Kay Larson is also a Buddhist who takes Cage seriously as a Zen adept. Cage was not actually a Buddhist, but he was so enthralled with aspects of that philosophy, so well studied in it for half of his life. He was absorbed in this, and many of the Buddhist ideas he studied infected his own personal thought and became part of his own set of ideas. Kay Larson published a book this summer called Where the Heart Beats. It is, in effect, a biography of Cage, and it is a very good biography of the first half of his life, but also points out along the way several small incidents that could have primed the young John Cage to be so receptive to Zen Buddhism when he encountered it in his 40s. Kay Larson will be here. She's the last speaker in the series, and she is going to speak on Cage and his relationship with Zen. The Ryoanji Zen Garden in Kyoto, Japan, it's well known as an important Zen garden, first of all, but it was also very important to Cage. There's going to be a lecture recital on November 8th. David Phillips, who is a professor at Wake Forest of the Interdisciplinary Humanities Program, a specialist in East Asian studies, is going to speak about the garden, the Ryoanji Zen Rock Garden. And the second half of that program is going to be our recent alumnus, Jorge Mendez Estrada, who will play one of the pieces that Cage wrote titled Ryoanji. This is for solo string bass with pre-recorded string bass going on simultaneously. I'm very happy with the way that program took shape. The lecture about the garden, a piece that Cage wrote, relating in his own mind to the garden, and taking place in the Haynes Gallery, where some of Cage's Ryoanji drawings are going to be on display.
Pianist, John Cage Scholar, Wake Forest University Professor, and Cage Fest Director Louis Goldstein. You can hear Louis perform Cage's Sonatas and Interludes on Wednesday night, November 14th at 10 o'clock in the Choral Rehearsal Room in Scales Fine Arts Center on the Wake campus. But in the meantime, there are lots and lots of wonderful Cage Fest events going on, beginning with an October 22nd opening of Cage Rocks Ryoanji in Haynes Arts Gallery. That opening of Cage's visual art is followed the next day at 5:15 with John Cage as a Conceptual Poet, a lecture by one of the foremost American critics of contemporary poetry, Marjorie Perloff. It'll be held in the Welcome Center Auditorium on the Wake campus, and you'll find a complete schedule on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're off to the mighty pipe organ. Timothy Olson's an award-winning organist. He's been called among the first rank of the new generation of American organists, and he's performed solo recitals across the country. Tim's the Keenan Professor of Organ at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, Associate Professor of Organ at Salem College in Winston-Salem, and he's coming to Music for a Great Space in Greensboro, Friday, October 19th at 7:30 in Christ United Methodist Church. On the program, music by Bach, Cesar Franck, Ned Roram, and more. Tim recently joined me for an overview of the mighty pipe organ. First place winner of the American Guild of Organists National Young Artist Competition in organ performance. When was that, by the way?
It was in 2002, and I was most of the way through my doctoral program.
Okay, so that was fairly recent. First off, what did you play, and then is it true? Is the organ the most difficult instrument to master?
It certainly is very difficult to master. If it's the most, I can't say, but it certainly is a challenging instrument. But to me, that's one of the exciting things about playing the organ is that, one, every instrument is very different. You may have two keyboards, you may have three, you may have four, or you may have five, like I play on Sunday mornings at First Baptist here in town.
Wow.
And the dimensions are different, the sounds are different, each stop is different from organ to organ, even from within the same builder. The room, as we've already talked about, factors into it, and so it's a challenging instrument. It's great fun to deal with those challenges. And for the competition, we had to do two recorded rounds and then also two live rounds on different organs. So each round was on a different instrument. So that's, again, part of the challenge. And it really prepares you for a performing career.
Was there sight reading?
No sight reading involved.
Okay. Thank God for that. See, I just can't. I mean, as a former clarinetist, the whole concept of playing with your feet and your hands, and then later, this the concept of improvising a fugue or something ridiculous like that. I just can't even wrap my brain around it. So, as a performer, though, are the tensions fairly uniform when you're going from organ to organ, or do those vary just as much as the other elements?
The key tension varies very widely from organ to organ depending on if it's an electric action or if it's a mechanical action. And there are even electric actions that try to imitate a mechanical action. And so the variance goes from extremely light to extremely heavy.
Tim, could you paint for listeners this issue of selecting the various sounds, which stops to pull, the orchestrational aspect of your instrument, and how much effort goes into just that?
For instance, when I go to a place out of town and play a recital on a weekend or something, if I play a Sunday afternoon concert, I'm usually there by Friday, spending basically 6 to 8 hours a day, Friday and Saturday, preparing for that recital, not to learn the music, but to learn the organ. And so the selection of stops is a very critical part, an extremely critical part, both because you've got different colors of sounds, you also have different pitches of sound. So when you play one key on the organ, you can get multiple octaves sounding at the same time, and the blend that happens between different colors of sound and different pitches of sound is very challenging to figure out which one is the best. And certain pieces certainly have their prescribed type of registration, but because every organ is different, you have to figure out what sounds best on that particular organ.
Yeah, I get to see you show up for the recital and, oh, I forgot my notes. Yeah. What do I do? You know, on the fly. That's like the exactly. organist's worst nightmare, right?
Exactly.
My thanks to first prize winner of the 2002 National Young Artist Competition in Organ Performance and Naxos recording artist, Tim Olson. Tim's Music for a Great Space recital in Greensboro will be Friday, October 19th at 7:30 in Christ United Methodist Church. On that program, music by Bach, Cesar Franck, Ned Roram, and more. You'll find links to ticket information and more at wfdd.org/triadarts. I'm David Ford. Glad to be along with you this afternoon for Triad Arts Weekend. More great music on the way. New Song Music is an independent organization based in Brooklyn, New York, that supports a community of performers and songwriters of all genres and skill levels. Each year, through its Mountain Stage Contest, New Song also identifies the best of the best within this community and introduces their music to a broader international audience. The winner gets an international broadcast on NPR's Mountain Stage program and an entire recording project produced by one of the music industry's heaviest hitters. This year, the contest finals are October 20th at the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts in New York. The winning album will be produced by Leston Polson, whose credits include David Bowie, Patti Smith, and David Gray. New Song director and co-founder Gar Raglan just happens to be a Winston-Salem native. He says when New Song was ready to take the program beyond New York, his home state was a natural choice. In June, Gar brought the award-winning Honey Dewdrops to the Haynes Brands Theater in Winston-Salem. And just last month, Gar and New Song announced that they've opened an office in Echo Mountain's internationally recognized recording studio in Asheville. We're sampling from the Honey Dewdrops right now. Gar spoke with me by phone from his office in New York.
Just like a silver lining in a cloud. When it don't look good, I'm always fine.
It's great to be working with the Arts Council and the Haynes Brands Theater working on this series, and it's highly rewarding. You know, these are artists that are really working hard, and they're trying to rise above the noise and get some recognition, and for us to be able to offer them performance opportunities and for a very select few to work with them on the release of their recordings, it's great.
There's really a focus on the musical aspect of what you all do in terms of developing careers. What sorts of prizes are involved with the winners and those who compete in this competition?
The grand prize has always been an opportunity to perform on an internationally broadcast Mountain Stage show through NPR. 3 years ago, we partnered with a producer management company out in Los Angeles who manages sort of the top shelf of music producers to offer our grand prize winner, in addition to the Mountain Stage appearance, a fully funded recording with a producer who they would otherwise not have access to work with. So 2 years ago, we worked with the Grammy-winning producer Jakir King, who had just a few months before won the Grammy for Record of the Year with the Kings of Leon. Then he has worked with Norah Jones and Tom Waits. And the winner that year, an artist named Amber Rubarth, got to go into the studio with Chakir, and we released on our label a wonderful record that charted in the iTunes top 15, and it really helped to take her career to the next level.
And in the vacant silence of a lost Manhattan boulevard, you'll hear the answers if you listen. When it's love, don't wait to say what it is.
Last year's winner is an artist from outside of Nashville named Arthur Alleygood. He got to go out to Los Angeles to record with Michael Blue, who is a producer most known for working with Jason Mraz and Colby Calais, more of a pop producer. And we just released in April the record that they worked on together.
That's what I told you when the walls came crashing. That's what I said when the words got lost. That's what I told you. It shouldn't be there. It shouldn't be that hard.
And this year, the grand prize winner will get to work with a producer from London named Justin Poulsen, who's worked with David Gray and David Bowie and Patti Smith. And we're going to be recording actually in Asheville, North Carolina, at Echo Mountain Recording, who is one of our contest partners this year. They're going to be offering the studio for 10 days for the record to be made there.
Wow, what a track record Echo Mountain has. I'm just thinking in terms of the production aspect, Gar, for those not in the music world, could you speak to what happens in the studio? Just an example maybe of how a Jakir gets a hold of an Amber Lumbeth track, or maybe you'd reference Justin Poulsen as well. Just what they have to, what they bring to bear in terms of experience and how they can really alter a performance in the best sense of the word, to really elevate.
Oh, yeah. A really good producer, in addition to having great technical facility and knowing how to get great sounds out of all the instruments, really as a coach with the artist, can really bring out the best. A good producer can work early in the process, even in the pre-production, making sure that the material is best suited for the particular artist. So identifying which songs want to be recorded going into the studio. And it can be actually, you know, performing some surgery of sorts on the material to make sure that it is as good as it can be, whether it's, you know, lyrical or structural or arrangements being changed. But I would say that in my experience, what truly separates a good producer from a great one is more of the psychological aspects of it. It's making the artist feel comfortable and confident in his or her abilities so that they can really put forth the very best of what they have to offer as an artist in the process.
As the outsider looking in, it seems like the ultimate goal of the artist is to be able to be honest, to be able to put forth a performance that's who he or she is in that moment so that the listener, it resonates with the listener. But that's not easy to do when you hear the people, just be yourself. Give me a snippet as to like a coaching word or phrase that you've heard in the studio before, Gar, that really put someone at ease and said, okay, now I can be myself. And then suddenly you get the goosebumps, whereas before it's just, I'm going to sing this song.
Absolutely. And that's really the X factor, I think, and what turns a good recording into a great recording and is what takes place in the studio, and that's authenticity. It can be just a small gesture or word of encouragement or constructive criticism in a previous take, and it's just looking at it in a different light, and a producer can really help navigate that process.
It's amazing how challenging it is to capture that in the studio at times.
It can be, and it can often be an intimidating environment for an artist. You know, when you see all the microphones and the isolation booths and, you know, the associated fees involved, it can all be very intimidating, and ironically, it can actually take the artist in the opposite direction of where they need to be at their very best. And that's what a good producer and a great studio actually, the vibe of the atmosphere is really important, I think, and it's how well an artist can feel at ease, and that's important. You know, Echo Mountain is one of the first things you notice when you walk into the studio, and you meet the friendly staff there, and it's a welcoming environment, and it's something that's instantly recognizable, and not only the physical environment, but also the personal environment. It's the people that you're with, and that's where the role of the producer can be so important into just being the coach and the champion of the artist in that situation.
Bright morning stars are rising.
The magic take is the one where the artist is totally in the moment and being completely honest with him or herself. and conveying that. And audiences can recognize that, whether you're listening to it, you know, in your CD player or in your iPod, or if you're at a live performance, it's that authenticity, it's the truth within the delivery that really makes great music so special and unique.
Happiness ain't happiness, it's a compromise, more or less.
New Song director and co-founder Gar Raglan. New Song's Mountain Stage Contest finals are this Saturday, October 20th, at the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts in New York. And the winner gets an international broadcast on NPR's Mountain Stage program. He or she also receives a recording project produced by Leston Poulsen, whose credits include David Bowie, Patti Smith, and David Gray. Last month, Gar and New Song announced that they've opened an office in Echo Mountain's internationally recognized recording studio in Asheville.
Change in the weather can change my mind.
Well, that's all for today's program. Our senior producer is Catherine Mobley, and our audio engineer is Eddie Garcia. You'll find links to more information about all of the arts organizations and events we've covered today on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for joining me today for Triad Arts Up Close.